Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, is gerrymandering a bad thing? A new book weighs in. But up front, as more Americans have gotten vaccinated and businesses have reopened, the nation's economy has come roaring back, at least on paper. There are some concerns. Inflation hit 5.4% last month, the biggest increase in 13 years. The higher prices have been very noticeable, too, at the gas pump, grocery store, used car dealership, lumber yard, and when buying a house. Help wanted signs are everywhere. Many, many jobs are going unfilled for a variety of reasons, and it's resulted in higher wages for some, or businesses closing or altering their hours for others. The stock market took a nosedive earlier this week, but then rebounded the next day. Much of what I just listed can be traced, at least in part, to the coronavirus pandemic. So where does the economy go from here? Joining us today is Heather Long, economics correspondent with the Washington Post, and of course, former columnist and editor at the Patriot News here in Harrisburg. Heather Long, always great having you on the program.
Hi, Scott. Good to be back.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. All right, so that list I just ticked through, Heather, it doesn't sound like the characteristics of a stable, strong economy. Now, maybe I need to separate the words stable and strong. Is the economy strong?
Well, it's definitely one of the strongest that we've seen in decades. And if you look at the overall growth of the economy, expected to be 7% this year. We haven't seen those kind of numbers since the early 1980s. So in that sense, you're right. It's really a strong economy. But, and there's all these buts, I sort of give it an A grade with a big asterisk. And the asterisk, as you pointed out, is there's a lot of fear that the economy is almost too hot. We're experiencing these price increases, very rapid price increases, the likes of which we haven't seen in over a decade. And on top of that, of course, there's also been a lot of challenges getting people back to work, the hiring has been a real challenge for many businesses right now who are having to increase pay, having to change schedules around to be more flexible and accommodating to what workers want in this new economy.
So can this instability, the things we just listed, even though the economy is growing at a monumental pace right now, can that instability derail a recovery?
It could. I think the big question is the most likely path forward is we continue to grow pretty strongly and we're expecting to see a pickup in hiring and expecting to see some of these crazy price increases, particularly on rental cars and used cars, even gas prices or airfare spikes in prices would moderate by the end of the year. So basically this is the reopening pains and that will subside a little bit as we all get back into a more normal mentality and as we're able to get factories fired up again around the world and be able to make more cars and make more laundry machines and airlines are able to add more flights back into their routes, you could see a scenario that by early next year, a lot of this really instability, as you put it, or these bumps, as the White House likes to call it, would be sorted out. But that's a big question mark. We've obviously never been through a situation like this, and we don't know if it's all going to sort out or not. And that's where this huge debate comes. That's where you see the stock market fluctuations the last few days, is everyone's trying to figure out, do you buy the story that this is a temporary hiccup or not?
You said that we've never been through anything like this. A pandemic, we haven't, our economy has not been through a pandemic like this. I mean, 1918, it's kind of hard to make that comparison. But what the White House has used as a comparison is after World War II, when price freezes were taken off, limits on prices were taken off, and you had so many returning from the military. Is there any comparison?
I would say no, not really. I think for me, what's really important right now is to pay attention to two things. Number one is hiring. We did see stronger hiring in June, but it was still below 1 million people a month. We still have almost 10 million job openings and over 9 million unemployed in the United States. And so we would expect to start to see hiring really pick up in the next few months. And if it doesn't, I think that points to some deeper problems going on in the economy or some deeper shifts that we fully don't understand yet. And the other thing that I'm watching a lot is we all know the crazy real estate prices. We've all had friends who've sold homes for astronomical amounts or had all cash buyers swoop in and scoop up a home. But one of the biggest drivers of inflation is rent prices. What happens to rents for apartments or for single family homes? And those are starting to rise in many parts of the country, including Harrisburg. I just looked up the data, you know, close to a 7% year over year increase in rent prices in the Harrisburg area. And many parts of the country like Boise and Phoenix and Memphis and Las Vegas are seeing double digit, over 10% rent increases. Rent increases are not temporary. Most people sign for a year or two, and they're going to be paying those higher prices for that year. And of course, when the lease comes up next summer, the price is unlikely to fall back down. It usually just goes up from there. So I think that's where some of the real concern comes in going forward. And that's where I get a little bit worried, not that we're going to totally derail the economy, but that we've got a couple of these building problems that we're going to eventually have to take care of.
You are one of the first. Now, you talk to so many people across the country who have, you know, provided this information, but you are one of the first to raise concerns about those rents going up. I've noticed in the last few days, just in other media, that it's starting to get mentioned. But, you know, what if the rents do continue to rise? How could that derail the recovery, and what would the result of that be, other than just people paying more money each month?
It's such a huge expense. So rent, you know, for many people is their largest expense every month. And it also makes up these inflation, like when you cited at the top of the hour, that 5.4% inflation that we've seen, over 5% in the past year, the highest in 13 years, about 40% of that number is made up by rent prices. So when rent prices are rising rapidly or rising more than what we've seen in the past decade or so, it will have an effect, and it will keep those numbers higher than what we'd like to see. And the problem that starts to happen is not only is it a real burden on renters, and I've certainly talked to plenty of people who say, you know, look, where do I find an extra $200 or $300 a month? You know, maybe my pay went up a little bit at work, like 2 or 3%, but if my rent goes up 6% or 10% in some of these places like Phoenix, you know, my rent is, or my pay increase is not going to cover that. And certainly as we have more and more, you know, people on fixed incomes as well, who are maybe retired, you know, they don't suddenly get some raining cash from the sky to pay for these higher prices. And so obviously it's a burden on people as they're making daily decisions about whether to buy food or medicine or put gas in the car or pay their rent. But for the economy overall, if inflation stays well at these really high levels, like a 5% for the next few months, the problem is that people start to expect really high inflation going forward. So their expectations change of what's going to happen down the road. And usually they start demanding even higher pay to try to, you know, be able to still buy things. And then that just starts this vicious cycle that many of us have seen already when you go to restaurants, and then the restaurants and other businesses raise the cost of goods. And then the workers come back again and say, well, now everything costs more again, so I need another pay raise. And it sort of starts the cycle. And that's what people are worried about in the economy, is if you, once you get in that upward spiral of raise the prices, raise the wages, raise the prices, raise raise the wages, then you're into something that can destabilize an economy, and the Federal Reserve would have to step in by raising interest rates. And let's just say the track record every time they've done that has usually led to a recession. So we're far away from that point, but that's sort of how you could see the beginning of something that could look really messy.
Or, you know, consumers decide not to spend money, to decide to hold on to their money. And as we well know, a major part of our economy is driven by consumer spending. You know, it's always been fascinating to me that when gas prices go up, that seems to be a bellwether for many people, that when the price of gas go up, they see that every day and say, you know what, I'm going to hold on to a little bit of money, maybe not go out as often as we most often do. So there is that. You use the term vicious cycle. A lot of this seems to be psychological.
It is. And that's where we don't have a full understanding. That's where we haven't been in a scenario like what we're experiencing now. The other, you know, you make a good point on the gas prices, and that's certainly true that has a big effect on people and what they're spending on a day-to-day basis. Maybe after they fill their car up with gas, they're not going to buy as much as a grocery store, or they're going to decide to cook at home tonight instead of going out to the restaurant. But what's different this time around, and another one of these sort of crazy factors that's hard to assess, is there was a massive amount of savings during the pandemic. So particularly among people who kept their jobs, who did not lose their work and their income, they were able generally to save a lot more money because they weren't going on vacations and they weren't going out to restaurants or entertainment venues on a regular basis. And so we have an unprecedented amount of savings that happened in the last year. And so that's why another factor where, even though you might normally, as these prices rise, expect people to close their wallets, we're seeing a slightly different effect this time around because there's this pent-up demand, as we call it in economics. You know, people are eager to go travel again. People want to be back at Disney World. People want to be back on the beaches right now. People want to be going to Hawaii and Alaska and anywhere that they can travel to, or anywhere that they can just be out with family and friends having fun again. I'm currently in New York City. Restaurants are teeming right now. And so that's what's a little bit different than what we've seen in the past.
Is there too much money in the economy? Is that one of the factors driving inflation?
There's definitely a huge amount of demand. And so that's why, and there's not enough supply. And we've all seen it in the housing market. Anybody who's looked for a home or accompanied someone looking for a home knows that there just are not a lot of houses for sale right now. And there's a lot of people still looking to buy homes. And so that's why it's a seller's market and prices can go through higher and higher through the roof, literally. And the same thing is happening in the used car in the rental car market. A lot of people are still looking for these cars. There are not a lot of cars that were manufactured in 2020, and so there's not a lot of cars that were traded in, and there's just not a lot of cars on car lots or in rental car fleets right now. And so that's why low supply, high demand, the prices are going up. Same thing with laundry machines. Anyone who's tried to buy a home, a couch or a home appliance, you know, I had these horror stories of waiting 6 months for a new washing machine or dishwasher to show up at your house. If you're lucky, the right one shows up and it's not broken. And again, it's similar situation. A lot of people were home last year. They were remodeling their homes or using their dishwasher more than usual. They need to buy a new one. And there simply were not enough of these items on the shelves. So the prices are up in crazy amounts, over 25% higher for things like a washer or dryer machine than they were a year ago.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Heather Long, economics correspondent with the Washington Post and former columnist and editor at the Patriot News. We're talking about the economy, inflation, jobs. We'll talk a little bit about the stock market in just a few minutes. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we're at smarttalkwitf. Heather, before the break, you know, what you described was kind of economics 101. Supply and demand is one of the reasons that inflation is going up the way it is. But we are in unprecedented times. You also talked about how people held onto their money. They got so much money last year in stimulus, number of people, a lot of people got unemployment compensation. So I'll ask that question again. Did the federal government put too much money into the economy? Has that influenced inflation?
It's definitely had some effect, no doubt about it. All of this basically unprecedented levels of federal spending. The argument in favor of it is the one that the current White House is making, and honestly, the Trump administration made as well, and that is it's better to do too much than not enough. We did not do enough coming out of the Great Recession, that 08, 2008, 09 situation, and our country suffered for years from it. So the idea was it was better to err on the side of doing too much than not enough, and that's certainly what happened in the past year with Congress doing three huge bills, relief bills. So yes, that's playing into the fact that that's playing into all this extra demand that we have right now. I think everyone also underestimated the supply chain challenges we have. Part of the reason that we don't have as many cars or washing machines coming back to stores and car lots is because we're having also unprecedented supply chain challenges and in getting some of these machines out of factories and onto ships and getting them from generally Asia, but all parts of the world to US ports. There was recently, earlier this month, a big shutdown in one of the major ports just outside Shanghai after there was another COVID outbreak there. And literally there's literally container ships, you know, just sitting waiting to go, but they're not moving. And so those goods aren't moving. So these are the types of challenges that are really unusual that we just, you know, haven't seen before, certainly not seen in decades. And there's no kind of magic solution to suddenly make all those workers in that Shanghai port safe and healthy again so that we can get goods moving in the economy again. Obviously, safety is the first priority right now.
The White House and the Federal Reserve have said that this inflation is temporary. But when you talked about rents a few minutes ago, that's not the kind of thing that you see a rent go up and a landlord come back and say, you know what, we're going to reduce your rate, your rent now. Many people are cynical that prices will come down. I mean, we already have seen some prices come down. Price of lumber skyrocketed. It has come down somewhat, still higher than what it was before. Some other items as well. Don't want to be cynical, but if this is temporary, when will we see prices start to return to pre-pandemic levels, or will we ever?
Yeah, it's a good question. So when we talk about the 5.4% increase in the past year, you know, we are talking about growth. So it's unlikely that we'll see prices, you know, truly overall slip back down. That would need to be a negative number. But what we do hope to see is a lot less growth. So historically, in the past decade or so, inflation has averaged just under 2% a year. So now we're experiencing 5%, you know, growth. The target that the United States government sets and the Federal Reserve sets is to be about 2% again. Here's the best read that I can get on this from the numbers that I pore over and the folks that I'm talking to on a daily basis. Nobody is really worried that we're going to stay at 5% forever, that we're going to return to over 10% inflation like what we saw in parts of the 70s. But what there is a real concern about is just what you were describing, that, say, these rent prices continue to pick up and these restaurant prices continue to go up, that we could easily end up at the end of this year, heading into next year, with inflation running more like 3% instead of 2%. So it's not a total, you know, pants on fire type crisis, but that is not where we want to be in the medium term or the long term with more like 3% inflation versus 2%. And so that's really the heart of the debate from the smartest people in Washington is what do we do when, you know, it's almost like when you're speeding, you know, maybe you're on the highway and it should be 55 miles per hour and somebody goes by at 70 or 75, like it's clearly higher than they should be going. And, you know, what do you do? How do you get them to slow down and at least tap the brakes to get back to a safer driving speed? That's sort of what we're talking about in the economy.
Heather, I want to talk about jobs and the stock market specifically in just a few minutes, but you wrote a column last month about the economy itself may never be what it was before. Maybe I worded that wrong. That makes it sound like it wouldn't be as good or as strong, but that it would be different after the pandemic. In what ways do you see that happening?
That column seemed to really resonate with a lot of people. And, you know, one of the ways we've been talking about the last few minutes is we are likely to have slightly higher inflation. Again, not something back to the 70s, but something that we haven't really seen before in the United States with more like 3% versus 2%. The other one that that I think is key, and many people are seeing this, particularly at restaurants or as they try to hire this summer, is I call it the great reassessment of work in America. You know, this wasn't just a typical period of layoff in the United States. You know, this was something that many people had their lives totally upended for over a year. Things were just drastically different, and it had a real psychological impact on people, not just an impact in terms of the health or in terms of losing income for a while, but a lot of people really, you know, reassess their life. They want to do something different now. Maybe it's spend more time with kids or have more of that hybrid work experience so they can be at home at least a day or two a week. You see that with white collar workers. But at the same time, I also hear from a lot of workers who used to maybe work at a big retail store or work in a restaurant who say, you know, I did that for years and I want to go in a different direction in my life now. I don't want to go back and work as a line cook anymore. I don't want to go back and work in a store anymore like I used to. I want something different with my life. You know, people are transitioning to jobs maybe that are in, I hear a lot of people going into real estate, which is very hot right now, or trying to get into education or social justice movements or something that's more environmentally friendly or more outdoorsy. And so, you know, people just aren't, basically the bottom line is people are not rushing back to their old jobs in the way that we would have seen and have seen after past recessions. They want entire lifestyle and work changes than before.
You know, there have been several reasons, you know, that people have listed as why the jobs are going unfilled. Now, you just talked about one of them, people making lifestyle changes and career changes, that kind of thing. But some have pointed to the extra unemployment from the federal government, that it's keeping some low-wage workers from going back to work. Other factors that we've heard is that some people are a little bit hesitant to go back because of the virus, that they just don't feel it's safe. Childcare is another big reason. But let me just talk about the unemployment for a moment. Is there evidence that that is happening widespread across the country, that because people are getting that extra $300 a week, that they are slow to return to work?
Here's the fairest way that I can answer this question. And this is as someone who looks at this data constantly and who talks to unemployed people and business owners almost every day. It is the extra unemployment insurance money. This is the extra $300 that's on top of an average of about $300 normally. So, you know, unemployed people are getting more like $600 a week with that extra supplement versus getting $300, which they would have gotten in a normal, I use normal in quotes, but, you know, in pre-COVID. It is having some impact, but I would say it's probably 10 to 15% or less of explaining what's going on and why people aren't going back to work. It's much more these other factors that you're describing, you know, people still hesitant to go back to work because they want to be spending more time with family, because they're trying to do a career change, because they're trying to start a business. We've seen unprecedented new business formation in the past year, you know, because they're still caring for people who are sick. These types of things are far bigger consequences and issues that are you know, causing workers to really rethink what they want to do right now. And basically the unemployment money and the stimulus money that you mentioned, those stimulus checks, they've given people a little bit more of a cushion. There is less sense of urgency. I hear so often from people, I don't have to take the first job available to me. I've got a little bit more time to try to find that right job or that better career, or see if I can get, you know, instead of maybe being in a restaurant, which they might not see as a career job, see if I can get that marketing or PR job or you know, sales job that I've always dreamed of.
Have a question here from a listener along those same lines. Wants to know, said a large number of states have restarted the requirement to show that you're looking for work in order to receive unemployment compensation. Any evidence in those states that unemployment has decreased as a result or the jobs have been filled?
No, so far we just got actually the data just came out Friday, state by state data for June. And so many of those states that like Missouri and Iowa and Mississippi and a handful of other states that began to scale back unemployment benefits, there's literally no difference in hiring in those states versus states like Pennsylvania that still have the extra money in place. I will say almost all states now have the requirement back again to at least show that you're job hunting, that you are applying to jobs in order to remain receiving unemployment money. So that's, you know, that did get reinstated in many parts of the country in the last few weeks. Again, hiring was up in June, certainly compared to April and May, but I don't think anybody really, you know, I think the much bigger story there is people getting vaccinated and feeling comfortable to go back to work as opposed to, you know, being required to do those job searches again.
Heather, I've heard many times that the stock market is not a good barometer of the economy. But it is something that people see every day on the news, and it creates anxiety when it fluctuates like it did this week. Dow Jones, probably the one market that we should be looking at the least, but still the one that everyone looks at. Down 700 points on Monday, back up 500 points yesterday. So what's happening on Wall Street?
Yeah, it was kind of a funny Monday in the sense that first of all, we haven't had a big correction. So when the market is going down, you know, 10% or something close to that, it doesn't usually happen in a day. But, you know, we really haven't had kind of the tap the brakes that what we normally see on the stock market in a long time. I mean, obviously, Monday's fall was the biggest this year. So in some sense, we were overdue for a little bit of a reality check. And obviously, that doesn't mean it's the stock market suddenly derailing. It just means that people are taking a breather and kind of a reassessment, should it be this high? I do think from an economics perspective, a lot of people were obviously citing the Delta variant as a reason the market was going down. But another one that you heard a lot on Monday was fear of peak growth. This term that was being thrown around, this notion that the economy is going to slow growth from here. And it's true on a very basic level, but you have to sort of think for a minute, what are we talking about? And what we're talking about is, yes, the second quarter of this year, so the period April, May, June, is probably the fastest that we're going to see, you know, for years to come. Numbers could be over 10% annualized growth for the second quarter, and that's probably going to slow down a little bit in the third and fourth quarter, but we're still going to be, you know, a 7% probably growth year in 2021, and the forecasts for 2022 are still quite high and sort of around the 4% range. And even in 2023, we're expecting, you know, maybe a close to 3% growth. And so that's way higher than what we normally see. Is it slower? Is it slowing? Yes, it's going to slow down a little bit from where these astronomical levels we've just experienced in the last few weeks. But nobody's sort of expecting, you know, crash type conditions anytime soon.
Quick question here from Jim in Lebanon, wants to know your opinion of the stability of the dollar.
Ooh, that's a good one. So I think the worries usually come on the stability of the dollar from all the debt that the U.S. government is issuing. We did just pass a milestone, certainly in our lifetimes, where we are now back at 100% debt to GDP. So that means the United States, you know, has over $21 trillion worth of debt, the federal government, and which is basically the entire size of the economy. And the thinking for a long time was that we wanted to stay, you know, basically when we wanted to have debt that was much smaller than the annual size of our economy. And we've, you know, blown past that threshold now, and we show no signs of stopping. And so, you know, there's kind of always these worries that, you know, are people not going to want to buy U.S. government debt anymore? You know, would demand for dollars somehow go down? Or would, you know, the world switch to wanting to own Chinese yuan, or the, you know, the euro from Europe, or a cryptocurrency or something like that? I think it's safe to say that in the short term, or even the medium term, the next sort of 5 to 10 years, the U.S. dollar is probably fine. And there seems to be no slowing of appetite for U.S. assets or for U.S. bonds or any other for dollars. Basically, there's no other rival currency right now that's seen as strong as the United States dollar. But I do think longer term, like if you ask me for the next 50 years, is the dollar going to remain, you know, the most prestigious currency in the world? I think that's a lot more open for debate. What happens in the long term, particularly if there is a strong, I don't know if it'll be Bitcoin, but a strong digital currency that would rise.
One final question, Heather, and this is kind of a little bit off track, but on my Facebook page and Twitter, every day I see people saying that President Joe Biden is the reason that gas prices are going up. Is he?
Presidents get way too much credit and way too much blame for gas prices. Yes, the United States does produce some gas again, but the reality is the price is set on the world market. We are up about a dollar from where we were a year ago, so I certainly feel it when I go and fill it up at the pump. But it's certainly not like Joe Biden or, you know, Donald Trump were sitting in the White House, or Barack Obama or George W. Bush were sort of sitting in the White House, you know, fiddling with gas prices. I think it's set generally by the world market and by OPEC, that cartel that includes Saudi Arabia and Russia and those countries. The good news is the cartel OPEC just decided to pump a little bit more oil. So we do hope that by the fall we would see slightly lower prices, but I don't think they are going to be as low as they were under the Trump era. But I'm not sure that presidents deserve, you know, a lot of blame or a lot of credit.
A supply and demand issue, if ever there was one. Heather Long, Washington Post economics correspondent, want to thank you very much for being with us, and I'm sure we'll talk again, Heather.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News. And all things regional, I'm Scott Lamar. Gerrymandering, or drawing up congressional or legislative boundaries to provide a political advantage to one party or another, isn't new. But as the nation has become more polarized and seemingly more politicized in recent years, it has gotten more attention. But is it necessarily a bad thing? Most think so. Franklin and Marshall College government professor Stephen Medvick has written a new book, Gerrymandering, the Politics of Redistricting in the United States. Dr. Medvick, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
I know this is a popular topic with Smart Talk listeners, so give us a call if you have a question or comment. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. There have been many books written about gerrymandering in recent years. What did you want to contribute with yours?
Well, I wanted to convey, I think, to readers just how difficult it is to draw district boundaries that satisfy everyone, or that even satisfy the criteria that are widely accepted as the standards for how redistricting should be done. I mean, the process requires just a ton of trade-offs. And so it almost inevitably will make quite a few people unhappy. I think sometimes we think, well, if there's a silver bullet that we could find that could just get rid of gerrymandering, everybody would be satisfied with you know, our representative democracy. And I think, in fact, it's just much more difficult. And that's largely because we have single member districts. And those districts are maybe good at representing areas of a state, but they're not necessarily good at representing the preferences of the public. And so that really is the root cause of, I think, the problem. Although gerrymandering, you know, makes it at least somewhat worse.
Now, you just said that, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, gerrymandering does happen and so many people are unhappy is that we have single representation in our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's all we've ever known as far as Congress and in the state legislature. I mean, was there a time when there were legislative districts that weren't represented by just one person?
Oh, yeah, for most of the history of the country, in fact. You could argue that single-member districts are sort of the exception in the long history of the country. If you go back to colonial times, we had what was called corporate representation or territorial representation, where there were cities or towns represented by multiple representatives, not necessarily based on population. As we got into the new republic, states could decide whether for their state legislature or for Congress, they elected representatives at large, meaning through the entire state, or whether they elected them in single member districts. So it really wasn't until 1842 when Congress for the first time said, you know what, we ought to have single member districts. But even then, there were a number of kind of carve outs. So there were some exceptions that were written into the laws a little bit later in the 1800s. It's really 1967 when Congress says, okay, that's it. There will be no more multi-member districts for Congress, at least. And most state legislatures kind of followed suit. Although there are still a handful of states that have multi-member districts, districts with two, three. In the case of New Hampshire, there are some districts that have 11 representatives per district. And I should say that, you know, we're a little bit of an outlier in the world. The United States is. Most democracies have multi-member districts, which allows then for a more proportional representation of the preferences of the electorate.
Your book says that most Americans see gerrymandering as a blight, a negative, unfair, undemocratic. I want to read a paragraph from the book, though, that, you know, raises some things for people to think about. There's evidence that redistricting both enhances and hinders competitive elections, that it gives the party controlling the process an advantage and that it doesn't, that it hurts incumbents' re-election efforts and that it either has no effect or helps incumbents, that it depresses turnout and that it has no effect, and that it contributes to polarization and that it doesn't. I don't know what to take away from that, Dr. Medvick. I mean, when I read that paragraph, you know, it goes against the common wisdom of many Americans today that gerrymandering or the way we redistrict is a total negative. In what ways are there those things that aren't common wisdom?
Mm-hmm. Well, I should say that, you know, as with all social science research, it's messy and it's complicated. It's really hard to get a good sense of what's happening because there's so many factors, right? There are just a lot of variables that we have to take into account. So you can find really good research published in top journals by great scholars that kind of finds conflicting or provides conflicting evidence. So if we take polarization just as an example, lots of people think that gerrymandering leads to these really safe districts, and that allows representatives to become a lot more extreme. But we saw polarization begin to rise at the same time in the House of Representatives. It was happening in the Senate. And of course, states aren't gerrymandered. We see that in you know, districts that are widely gerrymandered, and those that aren't, there's an equal number of polarized legislators. So there is some reason to think that gerrymandering doesn't have the extreme effects that a lot of people think. It's not to say it's a good thing. It's not to say it doesn't need reformed. I certainly believe it does, if for no other reason that it undermines faith in the electoral system. But it is to say it's kind of complicated. One other example I'll give, legislators, when they're redistricting, have to make choices. They may decide to protect incumbents by giving them really safe districts, or they may decide that they want to sort of increase their, seat, what's called seat maximization. They want to try to get more seats. In order to do that, they have to create quite a few competitive districts. There just aren't enough districts that are really safe to give a party a safe majority. So they're going to have to expand the map, in other words. That means we're going to get, through the gerrymandering process, very often more competitive districts than we otherwise might get. So, a lot of this just depends on the way in which maps are drawn. And they are drawn in different ways for different reasons in different states. So when you look at it overall, you say, well, in some places it seems to have an effect. In other places, it really doesn't.
Well, give me an example of where it doesn't. Because, again, I think that most Americans think that the majority party is going, that there's just no doubt about it, in the states like Pennsylvania, where they have the majority, that they are going to try to draw boundaries that would give them a political advantage. So give me an example of where it doesn't.
Okay, well, that's a great question. I think one good example might be Pennsylvania in 2018. If you look at, as most of the listeners know, the congressional map was thrown out in 2018 by the state Supreme Court, and it was redrawn to be, what appears to be and what really is a more neutral map. But if you look at some of the best prognosticators, people who look very closely at congressional races throughout the country and make sort of predictions on how many seats might be picked up, and I have in mind in particular Dave Wasserman from the Cook Political Report. I mean, he said, look, under the old map, Democrats in Pennsylvania in 2018 were likely to pick up anywhere between 1 and 4 seats. Now, what they ended up picking up under the new map was 4 seats. How many of those seats were because of the new map? And how many of those seats were because it was just a big Democratic year? It was a blue wave. As midterms often are, they're a reaction against the sitting president. So it's really hard to disentangle that. My guess is that Democrats would have picked up at least 2 seats, even under the old map, but likely 3 or even 4. So how much did gerrymandering really matter? How much did drawing a new map really matter? It's really hard to say. And I think it probably mattered, and it may have had an effect in a district or two, but that's the extent of it.
Mm-hmm. And again, most people look at Pennsylvania, for example, and Pennsylvania is half the states in the country do it the way we do, with the legislature drawing the maps or finalizing the maps anyway, you basically have a fox in the hen house effect, that you have legislators mm-hmm. drawing boundaries that they will vote on and that, they will adopt. Again, in our political atmosphere today, there seems to be this thought that there is malicious intent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there may well be. I think there are some checks on that, though. There are certain criteria that the U.S. Supreme Court has said have to be followed. You have to have, for example, equal population sizes in your districts. That is a strict rule for congressional districts. And what the court has largely said is that in state legislative districts, the districts have to be substantially equal in size, which means there can be a little variation, but not much. You can't discriminate based on race. So there are there are constraints on what can happen. And in a state like Pennsylvania, which, you know, we're about to go through redistricting this year, and there, the constraints are the fact that we've got divided government. So the legislature is going to draw the congressional district maps, but the governor has to sign off on them, has to sign it, or can veto the map. That's probably going to make a more balanced map than we otherwise would have had. For the state legislative districts, of course, there's a commission, a five-person commission, and that fifth person is sort of the tiebreaker. They've chosen this year the former chancellor of the University of Pittsburgh, Mark Nordenberg, who, you know, most people think is going to be really fair. And so those districts will probably also be more fair than they would otherwise be. But I think the point you're raising is the main reason why we ought to have gerrymandering reforms. So notwithstanding everything I said before about the effects being somewhat more limited than most people would assume, I still think it's worth reforming the system. And that's because most people look at it and say, exactly what you said. It's a kind of the fox guarding the hen house. If these people are drawing their districts before the voters can even make a choice, then they're selecting their voters more than the voters are selecting them. And that, I think, undermines faith in the system. And so for that reason, I do think that some fairly substantial reform of the system is necessary.
And in your book, you do offer some reform suggestions. What is, in fact, we've gotten a couple of listeners have asked, what is the best way? What are some of those solutions, some of the ways that we can improve this?
Yeah, so I'd say as long as we're going to keep single member districts, and the most radical reform would be to get rid of single member districts, have multi-member districts where the representatives are elected by what's called proportional representation. So if Republicans get 60% of the vote statewide, 60% of the legislators will be Republican. If Democrats get 30%, 30% will be Democrats. That would be the most radical reform, but I think the most fair and one that would bring us more in line with most modern democracies. That's probably not gonna happen, at least for a long, long time. So I think the best alternative then is the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. We have these in four states now, Arizona, California, Colorado, and Michigan. And what happens here is these commissions are made up of citizens. There's some randomness to the selection of those citizens. So citizens can apply to be on the commission. And then there's a randomness to the selection of who will actually sit on that commission. And those commissions are completely independent then from the legislature. There's ideally no political influence whatsoever. Now they take public input. And of course, people who serve on these committees have their own partisan preferences. But so far, the experience that we've seen in the other states that use it suggests that they turn out much more fair districts that people have more faith in. So I would suggest if we were going to reform the system, the best reform would be the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commissions.
We only have about a minute and a half left. I want to thank you for being with us today. But, you know, here's kind of a fundamental question. What is fair? And how, when you say that, you know, citizens view it more favorably, how do they view it more favorably?
Well, I think they view it more favorably from a process perspective. They think the partisanship has been taken out of it when the Independent Citizens Commissions draw the lines. Now, there may still be some partisanship, but again, you know, the way you set up these commissions really matters. And so one thing you could do is require that the minority voice on a commission has to approve any map that gets ultimately accepted. So there are ways that you can demonstrate through the process that it was a fair one, that all voices got heard, that not one party got to run roughshod over the other party. What people don't like about legislators doing it is that they believe, and probably rightly so, that they are motivated out of partisan interest. But your question about what's fair is a good one, because again, it is very difficult to draw lines that everybody will see as neutral and as fair. There are always winners and losers in politics. That's just a fact of the matter. And so it's, you know, as long as we have single member districts, at least, and we have to draw these boundary lines around those districts, there will be winners and losers, and there will be people who think the system's unfair.
We ran out of time, and I had a question. A listener had a question about why don't we just let computers do it? But you addressed that in the book. Dr. Stephen Medvick is the Honorable and Mrs. John C. Kunkel Professor of Government at Franklin Marshall College. His new book is Gerrymandering: The Politics of Redistricting in the United States. Dr. Medvick, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Scott. It was my pleasure.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.